That was great. And what a great story we're looking at tonight. Hey, we're just entering our holiday series. So the next 3 weeks, Gospel Bites. So basically three different preachers choosing a favorite story from the Gospels and bringing it. I love that story. And I've never had the opportunity to preach on it. So I chose that one tonight. Before we unpack it, why don't we pray together? Lord God, you're so good to us. Your love to us is just unfathomable, and the way you reveal yourself through your son Jesus in this story is just incredible. In Jesus we see so much power, but then such tender love and affection. We see someone who could have all the fame and glory in the world but just stops for that one person. I pray that we're just deeply moved and impacted by this story, but actually that it would also transform us to become more and more like your son Jesus. And we know that whenever we open up your word, it's powerful, it changes and transforms and shapes us. And we pray that tonight that we would come with the expectation that we would leave different people more like you, more like your son Jesus. We pray this in his name. Amen. I wonder if you've ever been traveling to another country or culture where they've just got a completely different sense and understanding of time to what we have. You ever heard of island time? Like you go to like one of the Pacific Islands and they just run on a completely different clock or like no clock at all. When we go to the Solomon Islands, we've been the last few years with young adults from this church, and island time is definitely a thing over there. So we go over, right? We take our group over, and we're all about itineraries and schedules. We have it all planned out. And you know, here in our culture, we're always busy, and we always have like a start and an end time. We don't want to hold people up or keep them from where they need to be. We love busyness. We don't want to waste people's precious time. And all of that just seriously goes out the window when you go to the Solomon Islands. Me leading my first trip over there, it was a massive change and challenge for me. The first year that we went, the church that we partnered with over there organized a minibus driver for us. He was going to be our driver for the whole kind of 10 days that we were there. And so we rock up, and on the first day, we meet this driver. And I'll just, I don't know, describe him to you. He's got like long dreadlocks. They chew that betel nut, and so it turns their teeth orange. So he just grins, and he's just got this big orange, like, it's so gross, this big orange grin. And in his minivan, there was just one CD that looped over and over again. It was just a mashup of Bob Marley songs. And so he's like this hippie, and he's like, hey, how's it going? On the back of his van was plastered this big sticker, and it just said, Yaman. So that was like his thing, Yaman, like Bob Marley. There's a little marijuana leaf in the corner on the... And I was just like, is this the guy that the church has given us like to entrust our whole team to for a week? We couldn't pronounce his name, so we just kind of called him Yaman. So every day we'd get our little phone out and I'd ring up Yaman and I'd say, Yaman, we need to be at church at 10:30. Can you please come and pick us up at 10? And 10 o'clock would roll around and I'd have the whole group there with their like backpacks on and like their Mozzie repellent on and their water purified, ready to go. You know, classic like, you know, short-term mission leader things that you do. Already on the balcony waiting for Yaman, and it'd be 10 past 10, half past 10. Quarter to 11, I give Yaman a call and go, mate, we needed to be at church 15 minutes ago. Where are you? No problems, no problems. Coming soon. So, oh, he's coming soon. He's on his way. He's going to get here. You know, 11 rolls around, 11:30 rolls around. And you're just thinking, like, we're especially like the guests of honor at this church today, and we're an hour late now, and we haven't even left, and we're 20 minutes away. Ring him up again. Yeah, no worries. Nearly there. He does rock up. But then, of course, we go to church via his friend's house to pick up something that he really needed. I don't know what it was. And we rock up at church, and I was just stressing, right? Because we're like an hour and a half late now for this church service, and they wanted us to be there as their guests. And we rock up to church, we rush down, there's like five people sitting there out of like 300 in the church. I'm like, what the heck? Where is everyone? No problems. Yeah, church starts when it starts, and like church ends up starting at 12, going till 4 p.m. So they just run on island time, completely different to us. And I've had to change and get my head around that as we go back each year. I don't think it matters what culture you're from. I think when it comes to God's sense of timing, all of us find him really confusing. All of us find that God's sense of the right timing is vastly different to our own. You know, if island time's a thing, I reckon heaven's time is like a whole nother level of confusing, and often we're like frustrated with God and impatient with him. And this is especially true when we're struggling and, you know, we're praying, we need God to intervene in our lives. You know, when you're battling and you need something to happen, or you need it to happen a certain way, or you're under pressure and you desperately need God to pull through for you and to act. And then he doesn't. And he doesn't come through for you. How do we respond? You know, are we patient, or do we just quickly give up or move into a space of doubt and confusion? And let's be honest, the last thing you want to hear when you're struggling and you feel like your prayers aren't being answered is your Christian mate come along and say, you know, you just got to trust in God's timing. How annoying is it when people say that? Because the reality is, we want God to act, and we want him to act now, according to our plans, according to what we think is right, according to what we think is best for us. We want God to act according to our schedule, and actually rarely does he do that. You know, so often in my life, I just don't get God's timing at all. And patience with God. Patience in prayer is something I've really struggled with over the years, and my feeling is that I'm not alone, and that this is something that a lot of us really battle with. So tonight we're looking at this. Well, it's one story. It was a long story, right? It's one story, but there's actually two kind of stories or miracles operating within it. And what's incredible about this particular story is not just the miracles themselves. They're amazing, right? Like, they're crazy, but it's actually the timing of them, and it's the way in which Jesus goes about them. And I think if we try and put ourselves in the shoes of the characters in this story, this man Jairus with his dying daughter and this bleeding woman, if we put ourselves in their shoes, man, we're just going to be like, Jesus, you're so confusing. Why do you act like that? And so we might feel that sense of frustration that we often feel. They certainly do. And so we're just going to work through this passage and see what it has to teach us, not just about Jesus' power, but also about patience. And so it starts in verse 21. When Jesus had crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the lake. Then one of the synagogue leaders named Jairus came, and when he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet. So Jairus, who is this man? We hear that he's a synagogue leader. You know, a synagogue is kind of like the Jewish version of church. And so this is a man of quite high standing within his community, kind of cultural and religious and communal life centered around the synagogue of which he is the leader. This is someone who was seen as a man of not just religious power, but also social power, an upstanding, moral, upright person who people would look to for advice and to lead them and show them the way. But here he comes, not with power and influence, but he's on his knees, right? He's begging Jesus. Why? See in verse 23, he pleaded earnestly with Jesus, "My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she'll be healed and live." And so Jesus went with him. It's full on, right? It's basically his dad has come to Jesus, and he's basically saying, "Jesus, my daughter is as good as dead if you do not come right now and heal her." And think of the anxiety. Think of the fear of this guy. You know, it's not like there's phones back then. He's actually had to leave behind. I don't know how far he traveled. He had to leave behind his dying daughter to go and find Jesus, and he's rushing back with Jesus not knowing what's happening, not knowing if she's alive or dead. Can you imagine the fear? Can you imagine the anxiety, that not knowing what's going on? But he has faith enough to come and seek out this healer, this rabbi, Jesus. And so this mad dash to rescue, to save this daughter begins. Jairus needs Jesus to be there as soon as possible, and there can't be any delay. And sure enough, like, this being a man of high profile coming to Jesus, like, this scene, this commotion, it starts to draw a crowd. And as it continues on, the story says a large crowd followed and pressed in around him, around Jesus. So there's this huge crowd moving with Jesus through the streets towards Jairus' house. There's people pressing in around him, bumping into each other everywhere. And a woman was there, verse 25. A woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all that she had. Yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. So if you imagine this mad dash, this rush of people towards Jairus' house, and in that crowd is this woman who's been bleeding for 12 years. I guess from what I can gather from this, her condition is like what we'd know medically today, is like a fistula maybe, or something like that. Often happens, particularly in poorer countries without access to kind of maternal health and midwives and doctors. If a woman has a labor, gives birth and things go wrong, the damage it causes can actually lead her to bleed and be incontinent for years if it isn't fixed. So that's just not physical suffering, but it's also social suffering. Because if you're in a place where you can't access kind of hygiene and things like no one wants to be around you, you would, like, this is really hard, like, you'd smell and you'd often stay inside and you just couldn't bear to face the outside world. This happens today. This is a massive problem in countries. You might know the Hamlin Fistula Hospital in Ethiopia, Australian-run organization that does crazy things over there. With women like that. But we can understand a little bit of what this woman is experiencing: physical pain, social isolation, a really horrible and desolate and lonely existence. So this is this woman. And it says she's exhausted all her options. She's actually spent all of her money trying to find doctors. And these doctors, you know, you can imagine, they're probably not that good and don't have that good of science and access to stuff back in that day. Instead of actually making her better, they've made her worse. So she's now worse, and she has no money, and she has no health care. Her situation is just unimaginable, but she knows that Jesus, the healer, this person she's heard of, is in town. And so this is her chance, and she presses through this crowd and tries to seek him out. It says, when she heard about Jesus, verse 27, she came up behind him in the crowd, and she touched his cloak, because she thought, if I just touch his clothes, I will be healed. And immediately her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. This is a really interesting little phrase. At once Jesus realized that power had gone out of him. So Jesus, perhaps not seeing her, he knows that a miracle, he knows that a healing has taken place. Some of his power has been transferred from him to her. And he turned around in the crowd and asked, "Who touched my clothes?" The disciples are like, "What the heck, Jesus?" They say, "You see the people crowding against you," his disciples answered, "and yet you ask, who touched me?" Like, they're like, there's literally hundreds of people pressing around you, bumping shoulders with you, and you ask, who touched me? But Jesus, verse 32, kept looking around to see who had done it. And then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet, and trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. Jesus is on a mission. He's racing towards Jairus' house, and there's no time to waste, and he's pushing through this crowd. But then all of a sudden he stops, and he turns around, and he asks this, like, ridiculous question, who touched me? The disciples are like, come on, what are you doing? You imagine Jairus in this moment. Why are we stopping, you know? Why are we stopping? We need to get to my house as soon as possible. What do you mean, who touched you? Come on, let's go. But Jesus stands there and he waits. He's like a stubborn school teacher looking for a confession from a bunch of naughty kids. You know, all right, who did it? I can wait here all day if I have to. Who touched me? Right? It's just ridiculous what is happening here. But then this woman, she comes trembling and afraid, and she falls at his feet and says, she tells him the whole truth. So Jesus not only stops, he not only waits to find out who did it, then when this woman comes forward, he stops and listens to her life story. Please tell me the whole truth. Tell me all about your situation. Just imagine this scene, Jairus' anxiety. Come on, Jesus, we've got to go. The disciples confused, like, Jesus is at it again. What is he doing? And then there's Jesus stopping for this one woman, composed and calm amidst the absolute chaos, bending down in this crowd to speak to this woman. Jesus just doesn't make sense in this scene, right? And this woman has a chronic condition. It's been going for 12 years, like, surely another day won't hurt. Come back tomorrow and have the chat. And yet she gets the attention instead of the dying little girl. Like, Jesus chooses to stop and talk with this woman who's actually already been healed. Like, it's already happened. So we can keep moving, right? But no, he stops and has the conversation while this girl is quickly fading. It's irrational, to say the least, but more than that, it's just irresponsible, right? Like, if Jesus was a doctor in a medical ward, like, you'd probably sue him for malpractice. Eliza, my wife works up at Hornsby Hospital in the emergency department, and sometimes she's one of the triage nurses. Do you know what that is? Like, the nurse who sits at the front and kind of decides how quickly you need to be seen. People don't realize, when you go to emergency, right, they're like, hey, that person just went in front of me. And like, yes, having a heart attack, you cut your finger, you can wait. Like, there's a system to it, right? And so Eliza gets to give people what's called a category. So if you're one, you need to be seen straight away. Like, this is an emergency. So when Andrew Duncan fell off a cliff, an 11-meter cliff at his house, and like landed at the bottom, he was a category one. He was okay, hence he's still alive and preaches here and is our pastor. Category one. At the other end of the spectrum is a category five, and Eliza was telling, like, it's a bit sad that she doesn't work anymore because I miss the daily debrief of stories from ED at Hornsby. All like confidential, no names and stuff. But like, here's this guy, right? He comes in and he says, I've got a really sore hand and it's been sore for a couple of weeks. And Eliza's like, okay, like, look, emergency, probably not an emergency. It's been sore for a couple of weeks, probably see the doctor tomorrow, but that's okay. It's been sore. What made it sore? Someone gave me a very vigorous handshake, right? So that's a category five. Like, the guy will be okay. Actually, in fact, Eliza's way of determining the categories is, if I can lock them in a cupboard for 2 hours and they'll come out the other end of the 2 hours fine, category five, you can wait in the waiting room. So pretty harsh, but that's how it works. But here's Jesus just flipping that on its head, right? He's got the dying girl, category one. And then he's got this woman. Yes, she's suffering, but she's been suffering for 12 years. Like, it's not an emergency. We can deal with this tomorrow. Cat five, you can wait in the waiting room. Jesus, it's just total malpractice. We should sue him, but we won't. Anyway, you get the picture. After that big story, I've like completely lost myself in my notes, but that's okay. Here we go. Jesus. So he's not going to be hurried. He stops, he bends down, and he listens to this woman. And while this interaction is taking place, in verse 35, we just see the inevitable happen. While Jesus was still speaking, some people came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue leader. Your daughter is dead, they said. Why bother the teacher anymore? Man, like, that's heavy. Imagine Jairus. Imagine how he's feeling in that moment. The desperation of the past few hours as they rush towards his house. And now this devastating news, that's actually all over. There's nothing you can do. Don't bother the teacher. Don't bother Jesus anymore. She's dead. And yet here's the turning point of the passage, because Jesus, it says in verse 36, overhearing what they said, Jesus told him, don't be afraid, just believe. Don't be afraid, just believe. Jesus calmly turns to Jairus and basically says, hey, trust me, don't worry. What? Like, she's dead. Don't worry, there's no rush. I've got this, said Jesus. He reminds me in that moment of Yaman a little bit, like, you know, an hour late. Yeah, no worries. Like, just relax. Don't be afraid and just believe. Jesus' timing is crazy sometimes. But here's the thing, you know, if you go, like I was saying before, you go to the Solomon Islands and you expect everything to run on time, if you expect everything to run according to your schedule and your itinerary, you know what? You're going to spend the whole trip being totally anxious and frustrated and annoyed. Nothing will go the way you want. Nothing will go to plan. And so if you want to free yourself of that anxiety, you actually need to change your expectations. And you actually need to seek to understand and embrace their idea of time. And when you do, your whole trip and your whole experience of that culture changes. And you actually realize the value of not rushing everywhere, the value of just engaging in conversation, just being with the person you're with and not rushing off to where you need to be next. And you begin to realize that maybe your ideas of time actually aren't that good after all. And the same goes for God. And here's, I reckon, the key thing we can learn here. God doesn't operate on our schedules. God doesn't operate according to our understanding of time. And if you constantly expect God to operate according to your schedule, if you expect Him to give you what you want when you want it, and to always do what you think is right and what you think is best, you are going to live your life in a constant state of anxiety and fear and frustration and disappointment with God. We will feel like Jairus feels all the time. We will feel like, Jesus, what are you doing? God, where are you? Why don't you show up? Why don't you do this? It's obviously the right thing. Hurry up. You need to act now. So if that's you, if you struggle to be patient with God, if you're battling and your prayers aren't being answered, and if you're like, God, why don't you come through for me? This is unfair. I'm so frustrated. I'm giving up on you. Then you need to hear these words from Jesus as well. Don't be afraid. Just believe. It's basically saying, you know, remember who I am and who you are. I know what I'm doing here. I'm in control. You need to trust that I know what is best for you. You need to trust that my timing is good and right and perfect, even when it seems irrational, even when it seems unfair, or like here, just like downright unconscionable, like how, Jesus, could you let this girl die? In those moments, don't be afraid, just believe, because here's what happens when we submit our lives to Jesus. We always end up giving more than we expected, but gaining more than we could have ever imagined. I'll say that again. Whenever we come to Jesus for help, whenever we submit our lives to His plan, we always end up giving more than we expected to give, but we end up gaining so much more than we could have ever expected. And you see that here when we go to the climax of these two stories, Jairus' story and the woman's story. Let's start with Jairus. Goes on, verse 37, He's talking about Jesus. He said, he did not let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. And when they came to the home of the synagogue leader, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing loudly. This is a horrific scene. I don't know if you've ever been in a house of mourning, let alone a house where people are mourning the sudden death of a child. But you can imagine how intense and horrible this is. And again, Jesus' response just seems so totally out of place here. He went into them and he said, "Why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep." And understandably, it says, verse 40, they laughed at him. After he put them all out, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him, and they went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and he said to her, "Talitha cum," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." You know, one translation I was reading was like, this is like the equivalent of a dad speaking to his little daughter and saying, "Honey, it's time to get up in the morning. Honey, it's time to get up." And immediately the girl stood up and began to walk around. At this, they were completely astonished. He gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this, and he told them to give her something to eat. Fair enough. She's hungry. Wow. Like, Jairus came to Jesus hoping for a healing, and his hopes are dashed, right, as he hears this news, the worst possible news: your daughter is dead. Not only that, it appears that his daughter is dead precisely because Jesus is seemingly just careless and stops for this woman. But Jesus is actually calling him deeper. Jesus is asking him to give more. Jesus is challenging and stretching Jairus' faith in a way that I'm not sure many of us have ever experienced. Like, that is so intense, right? Jesus tells him in the face of the news of his daughter's death to not be afraid and to trust and to believe. That is a test of faith like no other. So when Jairus comes to Jesus, he ends up giving way more than he expected to give. But man, does he get more than he could have ever imagined. He came for healing and he gets a resurrection, right? He gets to witness the unfathomable. He gets to see Jesus raising his daughter from the dead. And this is like, I mean, we get used to reading miracles, but this is totally unparalleled. I mean, this man is more than a miracle worker. He is actually God. He has power over life and death. He gets way more than he bargained for. And what about the woman? Let's return to her story, because we kind of left it just hanging there. She ends up giving a lot more than she expected too. She came to Jesus for healing, and she just wanted to touch him and run. She thought, if I could just touch his cloak, right, I'll be healed. And then I can fade back into the oblivion of the crowd from which I came. But Jesus wouldn't have a bar of it. He stops this whole crazy procession and basically demands that she show herself, that she go public. Now, keep in mind how horrifying this moment would have been for this woman. Her condition, her constant bleeding, made her a total social and religious outcast. I mean, socially, as I said, she would have just spent her days inside, away from people. You know, there were no sanitary products or ways of being hygienic or managing her condition. And so to face the public, to be out in public, was a nightmare enough. But more than that, her bleeding meant that under the Jewish law, she was actually ceremonially unclean. So women, when they had their period, they couldn't enter into the temple. They were seen as ceremonially unclean, and actually anyone who they had contact with during that time would also then become unclean. This wasn't monthly for her. This was nonstop for 12 years straight that she was separated from the faith community. And more than that, to touch a rabbi was just unthinkable, to touch a holy man. And so when Jesus says, "Who touched me?" her immediate reaction would have been one of total fear and anxiety. It says that, just imagine, it says that she came to him trembling with fear. not just afraid, she is literally shaking at the thought of confronting this teacher, this holy man, this rabbi. Who am I to come? I'm dirty, I'm unclean, I'm unwanted. So why does Jesus do this? Why does he make her go through this horrible ordeal? Why does he stop? Why does he take this time to find her and speak to her directly? Well, when you think about her faith, right? I mean, it was almost just a superstition. If I touch his clothes, I'll be healed. I mean, theologically, we know, like, she's way off, right? There's nothing magic about Jesus' clothing. But Jesus wants to give her more. He actually wants to push her deeper in her faith. And take a look what he says to her. He says in verse 34, this is the climax of her story. Daughter, daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering. He wants her to come forward so that he can say to her, listen, it wasn't you touching my clothes that healed you. It was your faith that healed you. It was that you believed that I am who I say I am, that I have the power to heal. It was your faith that has healed you. Jesus wants to correct and transform her superstitious faith into a life-changing relationship. And look how he addresses her. Daughter. Daughter, your faith has healed you. This woman came for a physical healing, but Jesus wants to completely restore her physically, socially, religiously, spiritually. This woman who had suffered for 12 years, she's now healed. She's free of the physical trauma and pain. But also this woman who was a social outcast for 12 years, this kind of nameless, faceless woman, is now brought before a crowd by the King, the Messiah Jesus, and called daughter. This moment of acceptance. And this woman who was religiously impure is now part of the family of God. She comes superstitiously hoping to get a physical healing. What she receives is a life-transforming, eternal relationship with the living God, with the King Jesus, in which she is called daughter. When you come to Jesus, you end up giving more than you expected, but you always gain way more than you could have possibly imagined. You always give more, you always get more with Jesus. And so for us, like, we might not understand why Jesus acts in the way he does, why he makes us go through the ordeals that we go through. We may not understand his timing. In fact, it might just seem not only unfair, but irrational and just horrible sometimes. But rather than respond with fear, rather than respond with anxiety and frustration and doubt, we are called to trust and to believe. Rather than seek to control the situation always and tell God what we think is right, what we think is the best timing, how we think this whole thing should pan out, we are called to submit our lives to his rule and reign. We are called to trust that he knows best, even when we think we've got it all planned out. Even when we think we know what's best for us. You know, let me tell you, like, Eliza and I's first few years of marriage did not go as planned. And we faced hurdles and challenges that took us from left field. You know, we've shared before, but our journey to start a family was, like, riddled with potholes and grief along the way. And through that, we're just like, God, what are you doing? Like, we had this deep desire to be parents, and yet we faced, like, huge struggles, like medically falling pregnant, and then went through a miscarriage. And in all of that, like, it was just full of grief, and it was just this time of just grinding it out in faith and just going, God, what's the point of this? Like, why is it panning out in this way? And there was fear and there was frustration and there was like just anger at times. But now, like, you know, it's epic. Like, here with little Jesse, our little baby, having come through the other side of that. And, you know, Liza was chatting with my dad today and he was saying, you know what, like, in some ways in your kind of 4 years of marriage, like, you've just condensed like 20 years into that 4 years. You've been through stuff that has actually propelled you forward in your maturity, in your faith, and has brought you together as a couple in ways that don't happen except through the crucible of pain and suffering and grief, right? And I don't know what God's preparing us for in the future, but I get a sense that we'll look back one day and go, yeah, okay, not how I would have planned things, not how I would have made it go, but God, you are in control. You do know what's best. You know, you do have our best interest in heart. We sang it before, that you work all things together for our good. All things. Like, we're people and we're broken people. We live in a broken world. We stuff things up all the time, and somehow out of that brokenness, God can just weave together just beautiful and amazing stories and somehow just bring about his kingdom into our kind of brokenness. That's the life of faith. Like, we don't get it sometimes. But when you come to Jesus, when you enter into a relationship with him, you're always going to give more of yourself than you expected to give. Just, it is how it goes. It's not an easy run. It's a tough run. It's a run of challenge and trial and persecution. But at the end of it, you know, he stretches us, he challenges us, he calls us deeper in faith. And sometimes we have to wait and wait. Sometimes we have to go through pain and suffering. But we face it not with fear, not with resentment towards God, not with this anxiety that things won't pan out, but with faith and trust and belief that what God has planned for us is far beyond anything we could have planned for ourselves. It makes sense. So we can choose to live in that anxiety, just like Jairus was in that space of fear and not knowing, but he just followed Jesus and he just submitted to him. Okay, like, I trust you, I believe. I don't know how or what you're going to do. And sometimes that's what we need to do as well. Take that step of trust, that step of faith towards Jesus. Why don't we pray together, and we'll just pray. I don't know, maybe actually it'd be good to just pause and allow you to pray for a little bit. I don't know what you're going through now. Obviously, people in this room are going through some really difficult stuff, but I'm just going to give a minute for you to seek Jesus in that, and then I'll close off that time after that. So just pray silently for a little while.